Setlist in association with 7 Digital.
This week, Take Down, Stay Down, Spotify and Pop Politics. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
And hello to everyone who got in touch about last week's first episode of Setlist, or the revamped CMU podcast. You were very nice, so that was good. Thanks.
No one was confused.
No one.
I met some people who were confused.
Some people were confused, yes.
I met some people who were very confused.
I'm not sure why they were confused. It was all very clear.
As to what this thing called Setlist is. I don't think they were confused by the podcast.
No, they just thought it was a new podcast.
I think they were confused by the messaging around the podcast. Once they started listening, we were pretty damn clear as what was happening. Yeah. I think it was when people saw the tweets and the Facebook and the fact that this podcast now has its own Twitter and its own Facebook.
And Instagram.
And it's got an Instagram. I didn't even know that.
That's
CMU has never had an Instagram before.
No.
So what are you planning on putting on the very visual Instagram from our no visuals audio-based podcast? What's the strategy here, Andy Malt?
Well, there's lots of graphics and images that accompany this podcast, and they will go on Instagram. And maybe, you know, I don't know, something.
You're going to get a webcam put in the studio.
Yeah.
And we could have...
Get that set up.
It was pointing at Matt next door there.
Matt's doing that now.
It's his studio. So, yes, we need to work out a way to make this podcast visual. So if anyone has any ideas of how to make this podcast visual, otherwise our Instagram will just be...
If anyone wants to put us on TV.
I don't want to be on TV. I like the sound of my own voice. I don't like watching myself on TV.
You don't have to watch it.
That's true. If anyone has any idea of how we could be visual with this podcast on our all-new Instagram feed, then let us know. Otherwise, the Setlist Instagram will be mainly Spotify logos.
Well, this could get into...
and mega upload logos.
Into it's fan engagement. Send us in a picture of you listening to the podcast and we'll put it on our Instagram page.
Draw us a picture of the things we talk about regularly. So Spotify, Safe Harbours, mega upload. Actually, we haven't talked about mega upload on podcast in a long time, but we used to talk about it quite a lot back in the olden days.
I think it might be on today.
People might be interested to know. I mentioned last week that now that we have a new name, new branding, new theme tune, that Andy Malt had composed the theme tune, showing that he's, you know, multi-skilled. He's a jingle writer as well as everything else. The other thing you may not know is that
it's the first jingle I've written in about 20 years, but good, yeah.
The imagery for the podcast that you will find on the aforementioned social media and on all of the podcast platforms like Audio Boom and SoundCloud and iTunes, and indeed at completemusicupdate.com or setlistpod.com.
Setlistpodcast.com.
I don't know. I'm not on message, am I, at all? No. Anyway, that image with the green paper and set list written out and a cable and what I think looks like a breadstick, but I'm reassured is a drumstick. That's original photography by Andy Malt as well.
Yeah.
So not only are you...
I'm yet to be paid for any of this stuff.
...bringing your jingle skills to the table, you're also bringing your art, your photography to the table. We didn't ask you to do any of it. That's why you haven't been paid for any of it. The trick is to wait for a commission.
No, I'm owed.
And then do the work. Of course, as we have discussed, if you were to now join PRS, the Performing Rights Society...
Which I might do.
...and log that little jingle you have created, then every time this podcast goes out, we would owe you some money. And if we didn't pay, we'd be in violation of copyright law and PRS would sue us, which would be quite fun because we could then talk about that on the podcast.
We could. Because that's creating our own news.
It's the sort of thing we would talk about on the podcast. Yeah. Hey, this week we could have done with creating our own news. It's been a very quiet week in the music business.
Well, no, it hasn't.
Right. Actually, there have been some big stories, but not stories we want to talk about on the podcast, which Andy Mott will now explain.
We should reference that. Yeah, there have been some big stories, but it's really... not appropriate to discuss the business implications of either of them. One, obviously, is the attack on the Route 91 Harvest Festival, which is just horrific.
Yeah, very horrible events in Las Vegas over the weekend at that music event. So, yeah, a very big event indeed, and not a very nice one, but certainly not really appropriate, well, for us to talk about in our informal, irreverent way, and also to even begin to talk about that from a business perspective. So, yeah, we should acknowledge that event has happened. It is a very big event, but not appropriate for our podcast. And then the other sad development this week...
is Tom Petty died at just 66 years old. And quite suddenly... Well, that was a weird... I mean, I suppose you could discuss the media implications of that, in that it was kind of announced that he died and then was still alive and then I went to bed and he was alive again and then woke up and he died.
It so is
that was
true.
A very but yes, he died alarmingly young and having just finished a tour.
What you're referencing there is that news broke that he had been rushed into hospital,
yeah,
and that some media were then rather too quick to then go on to say that that had meant he died. So then, yes, there was another flurry of stories saying, actually, hang on, that's getting ahead of ourselves. But then subsequently, the official statement came out. So it wasn't that they were completely wrong, they were just too soon. I suppose that's the sort of thing that happens in the 24/7 online news era where everyone is desperate to be first with the news.
Yes.
And don't necessarily 100% fact check before they put the headlines out there. So yeah, two big stories this week, which are very sad and which are not appropriate to talk about on the podcast. And once those stories are taken off the list, there wasn't a huge amount of developments in the music business this week, although a few interesting things, some of which are new, some of which really are developments on existing stories, but they do give us an opportunity to reference some stories that actually have been developing while we were away on our big, massive 2-month break. So there is still plenty to talk about. Don't be thinking that you're getting away with a 4-minute podcast. We're still going to be here for more or less the usual time, but if we ever have another week where we're short, if PRS could sue us because we haven't paid for the jingle that you wrote as a PRS member, that would be an extra little story that we could talk about. What are we going to talk about?
Well, this week we're going to talk about how musicians in the UK have been getting political this week. We're going to be talking about the ongoing issue of mechanical royalties for the streaming services, particularly Spotify. But first, we're going to talk about the European Commission's new guidelines on dealing with online piracy.
This is actually a new report dealing with illegal content at large. So it's a number of recommendations. They are guidelines. It's not a directive, they're not regulations, they're not actually new rules or laws being put into place, but they are guidelines coming from the European Commission about dealing with illegal content online. So beyond piracy, beyond copyright infringement, that includes things like content that incites violence or which encourages and supports terrorist activity. And it was quite interesting, obviously, from our perspective, we're interested in what this report says about copyright infringement and about tactics to deal with piracy online. When you go to the actual report, much of the introduction where it sets everything up talks a lot more about taking measures against hate speech and encouraging terrorism. That's very much the dominant theme in the introduction, and then it almost throws in copyright infringement as an afterthought. But then when you go into the guidelines and you're looking at some of the recommendations, quite a lot of them are specifically to do with copyright infringement rather than the other things that it's trying to target. So although this wasn't positioned so much as being a big document on copyright, actually once you started digging in there, it was. And as a result of that, we got a lot of responses from both the copyright industries, including the music industry, and from the tech industries who may have to do more work to combat piracy as a result of these guidelines.
Yeah, it acknowledges that safe harbor protection is a thing that exists, basically. And if one of your users puts something onto your servers, then the onus is on the copyright owner to inform you that that is there so that you can take it down. And you, the server owner, won't be liable for having that content there so long as you do that. But it then goes into some details on what actually qualifies as a safe harbor system, which the law in Europe and the US generally been a bit vague on.
Yeah, so to qualify for this safe harbour protection that you've just explained, the law does say you must offer this takedown system so that as a copyright owner, I can come along and say, that's my content, it's infringing my copyright, take it down. But all the law really says is to have this safe harbour protection, you must offer a takedown system. Full stop.
Yeah.
And then it doesn't really explain what that means. And in the early days of safe harbour, particularly in the US, whenever that went to court, and judges sort of gave opinions on what a good takedown system should look like, they seemed to set the bar very low.
Yeah.
That a not very good takedown system was nevertheless a takedown system, and therefore you got safe harbour protection. And so therefore the content industries and the music industry has been particularly vocal on this, have been pushing for a while now that no, the law should be much more clear on what a takedown system is, and it should set certain obligations that at the moment quite a lot of people who claim safe harbour protection aren't necessarily delivering with their takedowns.
Yeah, and so a lot of, well, illegal slash grey area services have kind of thrived on offering a very basic takedown system, simply that there's an email address. If you send an email saying, this file is on your website here and we own it, take it down, they'll take it down, but then someone will re-upload it 10 minutes later and it just keeps going up and down. So it's basically a whack-a-mole system is what people call it, isn't it? You've endlessly got to keep taking down the same content over and over again. And what the EC has said is that they would favour a system that's take down and stay down. So you've got to have technology in place that once you've taken down that content, your system can recognise when someone tries to re-upload the same content and just not allow it, as YouTube does with Content ID.
That's the irony here, isn't it? Because normally when we're talking about safe harbours and the music industry's dislike of safe harbours, we're laying into YouTube. But that's not about the takedown system bit. The issue with YouTube is that the music industry thinks that YouTube shouldn't have safe harbour protection, however good its takedown system is. The argument being, it's a user upload platform, it's not an internet service provider, it's not a simple server hosting company, so therefore it shouldn't enjoy these extra protections. However, when it comes to all the other internet companies, where the music industry isn't saying they shouldn't have safe harbour protection, so it's happy for internet service providers and server hosting companies to have safe harbour protection, but there they're saying, but the takedown systems aren't good enough, we don't have this takedown stay down you refer to. So it's sort of ironic that actually when it comes to the whole takedown issue, YouTube is doing exactly what the music industry wants, yet the music industry doesn't want YouTube to have safe harbour protection. When it comes to everybody else, what they want is for them to introduce something like YouTube's Content ID. So yeah, once you've taken down the content once, if anyone else tries to re-upload it, the system says, ah, we know what that is, we know that shouldn't be here, and we're automatically going to delete it. And the music industry has been banging on about takedown, stay down for a while, particularly here in the UK, actually. The BPI, the Records Industry Trade Body, has been lobbying hard on that.
Yeah, and in the UK last year, that lobbying got a voluntary agreement with the big search engines on how they deal with takedowns.
Yeah, so the UK government got all the various copyright industries around the table and then got Google and Bing were there too, because Bing still exists. Although really, when it comes to search, we're talking about Google.
But and Ask Jeeves.
Ask Jeeves and DuckDuckGo.
DuckDuckGo, yeah.
Let's not forget DuckDuckGo, except they did forget DuckDuckGo because I don't think they were part of these conversations. And so they have the big search engines there and they have the copyright owners there and they basically hammered out a voluntary agreement. So this was specifically for search engines rather than, say, internet service providers or server hosting companies saying that, okay, you do have a takedown system. We are participating in that takedown system. The BPI is one of the biggest submitters of takedown notices against Google.
In the world.
In the world, yeah. So very prolific when it comes to getting links to copyright infringing content removed from the Google search lists. And as a result of that voluntary agreement, Google and Bing have agreed to do more to try and ensure that piracy content does not appear in its listings, or it appears so far down its listings that no one would ever get there. But it's interesting with that UK voluntary agreement in place, then seeing over in Europe these guidelines coming out. Obviously, these are just guidelines, so there aren't actually any specific commitments in there by the various different internet companies this would affect. But there were some parallels there about looking for commitments and definitely saying, we think that you should be. They weren't going as far as to say, you must have takedown, stay down, otherwise you lose safe harbour. I don't think they were quite that forthright, but they were definitely saying we would support and advocate that a good takedown system should have this takedown,
stay down.
Well,
like you say, this isn't a legally binding thing. It's they're guidelines.
But I suppose, as is often the case when governments or the European Commission put out guidelines with the sort of the threat at the bottom of this is an opportunity for the internet companies to put their houses in order, and if they don't, then maybe next year we'll actually start discussing putting some new laws in place to try and make this happen. Obviously, the music industry, the copyright industries were very happy with these guidelines, even though much of the top of the report was dealing with the content that incites violence and terrorism, etc. But they were pretty happy that this was in a formal document coming out of the EC. As for the tech sector,
mixed responses. Some positive, some not so positive. So the Computer and Communications Industry Association, which reps various web giants, said that it has advocated for a long time for the introduction of well-thought-out notice and action guidelines. And these guidelines are a welcome initiative for a more aligned approach on the removal of infringing content across the European Union. Fairly upbeat.
Pretty supportive.
Now, the lobbying group, European Digital Rights,
which actually I think has some members in common with the Computer and Communications Industry Association.
Less keen.
Said,
this document puts virtually all its focus on internet companies monitoring online communications in order to remove content that they decide might be illegal. It presents few safeguards for free speech and little concern for dealing with content that is actually criminal.
And I suppose that is the other side of this argument. Whenever new rules and regulations are proposed to deal with illegal content online, whether that is copyright infringing stuff or otherwise illegal, is the argument of, well, who is to say that one piece of content is illegal beyond a court of law, who has the power to say that something is illegal. And you do have all the free speech ramifications of could these rules be abused in order to infringe people's free speech. The guidelines reference free speech, and they very much talked about having to balance dealing with illegal content online, but at the same time protecting people's free speech rights online. But I think what this European Digital Rights Group was saying was, okay, at the top you talk about the need to protect free speech rights, but once you get into your actual guidelines, you seem to have forgotten that side of the equation. Was their allegation, of which I'm not here to support them, I'm not here to oppose them. We're just here to present the facts, aren't we?
Yes. So when I issue my takedown notice to stop you from using my artwork and music in this podcast, I hope that you will operate a proper system.
I will gladly take
it
down.
Keep the whole thing down.
Oh, no, stay down.
Don't want anyone hearing this.
I'll take it down once, but then if someone, it wouldn't be me, but if someone out there who'd already got a copy of Setlist Podcast wanted to re-upload it, what am I to do?
Still to come, some news in brief and some pop politics, but now we're going back to the Spotify mechanical royalties debate.
We certainly are.
Yeah, so it's obviously something we have covered in great detail already. If you really want to know the nuts and bolts of this story, you can go back down the feed to July, when we had a whole special edition for the podcast where you really delved into the problem of mechanical royalties for Spotify in the US with Rebecca Brooke on a week when I wasn't here.
Indeed. And, unfortunately, when the podcast was called the CMU Podcast.
And if you go into the new iOS 11 podcast app, when you go into the page for any podcast, it gives you a best of the podcast, and that edition comes top of the best of. So I'm really glad to see an edition that I wasn't on listed as the best ever edition of the podcast.
But perhaps we should recut it with the Setlist branding now that we've changed and we're denying there ever was a CMU podcast.
That's too much effort, isn't
it? But if you want the background to the story as to why mechanical royalties are a disaster in the streaming market in the US, go back and listen to that edition. But the reason we're talking about this week is twofold.
Yes.
First of all, because there's been a specific development this week, and also because there was an interesting development about this story while we were away.
Yes. So the development this week is that Spotify has hired Adam Parnes, formerly of Pandora, to be its new global head of publisher licensing. So he's basically the publisher liaison. He's the guy who has to be friendly with the publishers.
And although it's a global role, he is based in New York.
Yeah.
So he's going to be nearest to the American publishers where all the problems are.
And taking on that role, it comes at a particularly fraught time for publisher relations at Spotify because of the ongoing mechanical royalties issues that they have. But also because although Spotify tried to make this problem go away by throwing money at it, it didn't work and people keep suing them over mechanical royalties. And in one of those court cases over the summer, Spotify came out with a new defence, which was that actually it doesn't think it needs to pay mechanical royalties at all. And that's not actually as controversial as it sounds, but as soon as Spotify starts saying we don't think we need to pay royalties, people got really annoyed.
And crucially, publishers and songwriters who to date have been friends of Spotify in America, rather than those who have been enemies of Spotify throughout, were not impressed with that new defence. So whereas actually, although there have been some very vocal, high-profile critics of Spotify in the songwriter and music publisher community in the US, they have plenty of songwriters and publishers who think Spotify are brilliant, and they still do think Spotify is brilliant, but they think that this new defence that is mechanical royalties aren't due is a dramatic new defence that is, in their minds, controversial, and therefore they're not very impressed with that. And I mean, just to very quickly explain why they've come to the table and said we don't think mechanical royalties are due. So as we've discussed, and you can go back and listen, there's all this litigation around not having paid mechanical royalties, and there are unpaid mechanical royalties. But at the same time, they are paying performing right royalties to publishers and songwriters.
That's because, yeah, the complicated way that streaming works means that they pay both mechanical royalties for making a copy, but also performance royalties for broadcasting it. So they kind of, it straddles, it's not like selling a CD in a shop and it's not like radio, it's somewhere in between, and so it ends up paying all the royalties.
So it is paying money through BMI and ASCAP and the smaller collecting societies on the performing rights side, and that's all going fine. I mean, it's all going fine from Spotify's perspective. Whether or not the songwriters are getting their money, we don't know. But crucially, that's not Spotify's problem. It's BMI, ASCAP and the smaller societies' problem. Spotify hands over the money and then the societies may or may not get it to whoever is due.
Yes.
Whereas on the mechanical side, Spotify needs to pay the mechanical royalties directly to the songwriters and the publishers. It is in some cases, it's not in some other cases. And that's a problem because there is no blanket license collecting society system for mechanical royalties in the US, even though there is in every other country. And so that's why mechanicals are such a mess. And so basically what Spotify are trying to do with this new defense is to say, well, if we could change the system so that we pump all of our payments through the performing rights system, through BMI and ASCAP, and nothing through mechanicals, at the other end, songwriters and publishers would still get the same amount of money. It's not that we want to pay them less money, but if we could just run it all through the collecting societies on the performing rights side, then this wouldn't be our problem anymore. And the fact that mechanical royalties in the US is a mess and always has been would cease to be our problem. So that's what they're trying to do. And the only way they can do that is to basically argue a stream is not a mechanical copy, it's only a communication or a broadcast or whatever you want to call it, and so everything should go through the collecting societies. You're right to say this isn't as controversial as it first seems in that it's not Spotify trying to pay songwriters and publishers less money, which I think is what a lot of people assume. It's not about paying less money. But it is controversial in that it is going against the generally held consensus ever since on-demand streaming arrived, that an on-demand stream is both a copy and a communication at the same time. Something that Spotify itself had said on various occasions.
It was quite an about turn for Spotify.
In formal documents. And so, therefore, although I totally understand why they're doing it, they're trying to say, we have money for you guys. We have this system over here through ASCAP and BMI where we get that money to you. And then there's this shitstorm over here that we are struggling to deal with. It's costing us tens of millions. The lawsuits keep flowing in. There must be a way that we can just shunt all the money over here rather than shunting the money over here. So there is a logic behind what they're doing, although legally it was a very dramatic new defense. And as I say, the crucial point in regards to the challenge ahead of this new guy whose job is to go and keep all the publishers happy is that those publishers and songwriters who have been getting their mechanical royalties, because Spotify know who they are, where they are, and they get the money to them. So to date, they've basically been happy with the system as it is. They're not suing Spotify. They're not bad-mouthing Spotify. But they're not impressed with this idea that all the money should go through collecting societies. Now, you could say, why? Isn't it a good solution to run everything through BMI?
It does sound like quite a good solution.
And in some ways, it is a good solution. I think probably the main reason why the publishers in particular don't want that is that usually what happens with publishing royalties, the royalties that come in for the song copyright, is that when things flow through the collective licensing system, the money gets split 50-50 at the collecting society, half goes to the songwriter, half goes to the publisher. Whereas on the mechanical side, this varies from country to country actually, but in the UK, Canada, America, on the mechanical side, all the money goes to the publisher, who then pays the songwriter subject to contract. So if the songwriter hasn't recouped on their publishing contract, the publisher gets to keep all the money. So therefore, when you get a stream which is both performing rights and mechanical rights at the same time, for the publisher is concerned, they would like it to be 99% mechanical and 1% performing. Yeah. Actually, for songwriters, it would be the other way around. So actually, the songwriters should be supporting this proposal to run everything through the performing rights, and they're not.
Well, they're not because people, as I said, all people see is Spotify is saying it doesn't want to pay royalties. And so they're getting annoyed, whereas actually, they're getting angry about something that would be better for them.
This is not going away for Spotify, despite the fact that in the last 12 months they committed to pay tens of millions in damages for not paying these mechanicals, which again makes it insane to now say mechanicals aren't due. Why did you commit all that money for royalties you're now claiming weren't due? But it would be really good for Spotify to kick all of this out of the... where could they kick it out of? Out of the playground. Out of the...
Park.
Before they list on Wall Street, on the New York Stock Exchange, which we are now. The latest word on this is that they should file the paperwork for their direct listing on the New York Stock Exchange by the end of the year for a listing in the first half of 2018. And they could really do with all of this out of the way before that happens. Although I don't think it is going to be out of the way before it happens now. They might just have to go to Wall Street with it still pending, unless, of course, Adam can do some schmoozing, and perhaps by Christmas they'll all be best friends.
Well, yes, because, well, Adam Pollitt, as I said, joined from Pandora, and you might think, well, wow, Pandora had some really fraught times with publishers, so probably really good at that, although he only joined Pandora in July last year, so he didn't really have to deal with all of that. So who knows if he's any good at dealing with angry publishers?
Yeah, prior to that,
I guess we'll find out.
Prior to that, he was Amazon, and prior to that, he was Rhapsody. I can't remember what the songwriters and publishers thought about either of those, but he wasn't there when Pandora was feeling the heat, but he will definitely feel some heat in this new job. So good luck!
Well, winter's coming, so maybe feeling some heat is a good thing.
Cold winters in New York.
Let's all gather around Adam to keep warm this winter. Just quickly, time to run through a few other stories from this week's music business news in brief. Largely updates to existing things that we've discussed before, so you can go back and listen to more detailed reports on any of these stories,
I think. You're doing a very good job of plugging old podcasts now that we have a new name.
Well, you know, they're still there.
Obviously inspired by iOS's new podcast app, putting the best bits in the archive function.
Spinal Tap, as previously discussed, are suing Universal Music owner Vivendi, Universal and Vivendi's films business Studio Canal, over royalties or lack thereof they have or have not received for Spinal Tap over the last 40 years.
There was a development in the last week with a new proclamation from the court that is overseeing this case. It was one of those classic judgments where both sides were claiming victory.
Yeah.
So there was some real mixed reporting on this story. Some saying Vivendi have really done well here. And then others saying, this is a massive victory for Spinal Tap. I mean, it wasn't a resolution. It was just the court ruling on which bits of the case should proceed and which bits of the case should be dismissed and thrown out of court right now.
Yeah, so basically the development this week was that the judge allowed Christopher Guest's case to go forward but dismissed Harry Shearer, Michael McKean and Rob Reiner.
Yeah, because it's the four creators of This Is Spinal Tap who sued.
And so that's why Vivendi was saying, this is a big victory. But really, he wasn't saying that those three couldn't sue Vivendi.
No, the issue was that they had sued through their companies rather than as individuals.
Yeah.
Because they run all of their business affairs through little companies, as is quite common in Hollywood. But fortuitously, Christopher Guest didn't sue through a company. Because what the judge was saying was, your companies don't have a right to sue for this, but you do individually. So therefore, because Christopher Guest sued individually, his stands. So the other three now will basically just get out the Word document, delete the company names off the top, resubmit. There was one other thing. The judge said that there are fraud allegations in these lawsuits. And he was saying that the fraud allegations as currently set out in the lawsuits aren't strong enough, although he gave them the opportunity to be more specific about their allegations. So it did strip back certain things. It does mean that three of the four will have to resubmit their litigation.
But the case is still ongoing.
The case is definitely still ongoing. And I suppose another reason why Spinal Tap side were very much saying this was a victory for them was that ultimately Vivendi wanted the whole case dismissed.
Yeah.
And that is not happening. And we now expect the other three to A, resubmit their cases in their own name quite quickly, and B, to qualify the fraud allegations within, and then the whole thing will proceed.
Second in the courts, this is an incredibly long-running story. The US Supreme Court declined to hear an appeal in the Mega Upload Assets case, which is Kim.com and his associates' attempts to get back the assets that were seized when Mega Upload was taken down. It's about $67 million.
All the way back in 2012.
Yeah.
That's how long this story has been running. And that's how long he has been trying to get his money back. He has had some money.
Yes.
Some of those assets have been handed over to pay for his legal costs. But he wants it all back. And this was his, in terms of the American courts, this was the last attempt.
Yeah, it's been through various appeals in the US. And this was the last kind of avenue to do that. And the Supreme Court decided to not even hear the case. So that's it over in the US at least. But his lawyers this week said, we'll still go and fight this in Hong Kong and New Zealand where the assets actually are.
Yes, because Mega Upload didn't have a base in the US. It had quite a big base in Hong Kong. So they are concurrently fighting this through other courts too. So although in America, this element of the Mega Upload case is over, they will continue to try and get their assets back in those other courts. Meanwhile, back in New Zealand, the extradition proceedings to try and get Kim.com to an American courtroom to face charges of copyright infringement is still ongoing. Do you think they'll go for 10 years? Do you think it'll be 10 years before we get resolution on this?
Just amazing.
2022?
Yeah.
We'll see.
Probably. I think in 2012, we wouldn't have thought it would still be going in 2017.
Quite the saga.
It is quite the saga. Lastly, two of Guevara's executives are going to be questioned under oath.
Yeah, more court stuff here.
Yeah, a liquidator's public examination over, particularly over questions about how they raised funding for the streaming service.
And what they did with all the money. So, of course, Guevara was the Australia-based streaming service that went under earlier this year and sort of fell apart last year after its failed attempt to float on the Australian Stock Exchange. So various companies within the Guevara group have now been liquidated, and the liquidator, who is overseeing three of those, has said as part of the liquidation he is going to call a public hearing. So quite often with liquidations, it all happens behind scenes. Only the people who are owed money by the liquidated company are involved in those formal proceedings. But there is going to be a public hearing as part of this investigation in which various founders and directors and executives are expected to be called. And if they do show up, they will be questioned under oath. So there should be some interesting revelations about what happened at Guevara. All those people who used to work for Blinkbox in the UK, who also sued Guevara, because of course Guevara bought Blinkbox to launch a UK service and then almost immediately shut it down with no warning, which also went to court. I'm sure they'll be watching that with great interest. It happens next month, I believe.
Yes, so as I say, if you want to go and search back through the Setlist podcast archive, find old episodes of the CMU podcast list. It's the same thing.
There's one edition.
The same thing. Stop being confused. You can do that. That'll give you more background on all three of those stories if you find those ones. You can also read more about all of the latest developments on those stories if you go to setlistpodcast.com, find the show notes for this show, and there'll be links to all of them in there. And finally this week, pop's gone all political. And here we are to talk about it.
Party conference season, see?
It is.
So all of the various UK political parties have been having their little get-togethers in various parts of the country. And as a result of that, there's been some pop-related moments. The main story here is the story that we have every single year around party conference season, which is never a problem when the Labour Party have their conference, but is always a problem when the Conservatives have their conference and they start having pop music playing as people walk on stage.
Yes, pop stars don't like soundtracking Tories. That is a story we'd run every year. And the Tories never learn.
Well, I suppose they want some music playing, and B, legally, providing they have their PRS and PPL licences and the venues where they are gathering, then they are legally entitled to play whatever music they want without infringing anyone's copyrights. They just have to accept the flurry of tweets from artists who are pissed off that they've soundtracked Theresa May et al.
Yes, and if it were Theresa May herself, not et al, just her, she walked on to her then disastrous conference speech to the tune of This Is What You Came For by Calvin Harris and Rihanna, which I think was supposed to kind of bring her in like a triumphant boxer ready to pull her party together, which that's not what boxers do.
Stick with it.
Let's stick with it anyway. But
do you think?
It became more a metaphor for Boris Johnson waiting for her to mess up so that he could swoop in and take her job.
I know we're here to talk about the pop music element of this, and not the political element of this. But I've not actually watched the speech. I've only watched coverage of the speech, of Theresa May's big speech at the
Conservative
Party.
There was a lot of coverage of it.
But it seemed to be so many things went wrong.
An unbelievable number.
Coughing fit and the letters falling off the slogan in the background. Simon Brockin, how does he still get away with stuff like that? I don't know.
Well, that was, when that happened, all the media were saying, a protester has got in and handed her a P45. It's like, that's Simon Brockin. He has Simon Brockin's face. How do you not know who that is by now?
How many events now has he invaded to do something amusing because he's a comedian?
But even if he hadn't come in and interrupted the speech, it still went incredibly badly.
So it was a very disastrous speech. To the extent, it was so disastrous, particularly the coughing fit, that
coughing fits.
You almost think, were they trying to go for the sympathy vote? Were they trying to make us feel sorry for her? Because almost by the end of it, I was sort of feeling sorry for her because the whole thing was such a disaster. So perhaps behind the scenes, something really clever was happening. But that's not what we're here to talk about.
No.
We're here to talk about Calvin Harris and Rihanna.
Yes, because it all started with them. Theresa May walked on, presumably thinking, this is going to go my way, roused by that music. And Calvin Harris, not happy. Not happy at all. He tweeted the evening of that event, the Conservative Party conference playing my song was not approved. I do not support or condone happy songs being played at such a sad event. He also then offered medical advice to Theresa May, suggesting she had a liver problem.
In the early days of Twitter, Calvin Harris was quite funny.
Yeah.
Before he was super, super famous, he was quite funny on the tweets. He was almost like a proto-James Blunt on Twitter before he became quite so famous. So returning to form there by being quite
amusing.
A
real return to form, yes. Yes. And he wasn't the only person annoyed.
No.
Because Florence Welsh of Machine fame.
Yeah.
Also, she didn't, I don't think she soundtracked Theresa May, but her version of You Got the Love was used within the conference. And she also said it was not approved, and nor would it have been had they asked. And therein is the issue. This always comes up every year, as we say, and people say, oh, well, you know, why didn't they ask for permission? Because they don't need it.
It's a public performance covered by a public performance licence granted by PPL and PRS. Blanket licence, no opt-outs.
Yeah, you go to a building with a PPL and PPRS licence in place, play whatever music you want, so long as it's covered by PPL and PRS, which almost all music you're going to want to use is. And so, yeah, there's nothing. Obviously, people find out about this happening because it's on TV, but then once it's on TV, it's the broadcaster's problem to license it.
And
in most cases would again be covered by a blanket license.
You could change the rules of the blanket license to offer vetoes for political events. I mean, in some countries, there's a compulsory license that would stop you from doing that. But in the UK, we could change the blanket license to stop it. But if we did, what would we talk about on the CME podcast, on Setlist, around about party conference season? We would lose this customary traditional slot.
We would, although there was another...
There was.
Another story we could cover quickly.
Interestingly, perhaps next year, if the Conservatives want to play music that won't get them all these angry tweets, perhaps they should go for a Morrissey track.
Oh, I don't think Morrissey would like it.
Given his occasional right-leaning statements. Not a Smiths track, because then they get Johnny Marr going after them like he did when Cameron said he liked the Smiths. But Morrissey wasn't commenting on the Conservative Party conference this week.
No, he was back on UKIP.
He was following UKIP's party conference where they elected a new leader. They're 809th leader in a week, I think. They have a lot of leaders, UKIP. They don't really stick around very long.
Morrissey was opening BBC Six Music's Six Music Live Week, where they're having various live performances in the studio from various artists across the week, as the name suggests. And I would say Six Music is probably the least UKIP-y radio station there is. And so when he got up in front of an audience of Six Music listeners and Six Music people, made of Vale Studios, and started spouting conspiracy theories about the leadership vote for UKIP, and was met with silence, and then accused the audience of not watching the news.
Although I accused Morrissey of occasionally putting out seemingly right-leaning statements, which he does.
He does.
Sometimes.
He said Brexit was magnificent.
Although technically Brexit's not a left-right thing, but...
It's quite right.
This statement he made about UKIP, actually, it's really odd. I don't know what he's saying.
No, he's supporting. I think that was it. He sort of got a bit shirt with the crowd for not. I don't know what he wanted, but not fainting or laughing or something.
So he suspected there was a conspiracy that had stopped the second place contender from being the first place contender, and she was the really racist one.
Yeah. So the one of the favourites. Anne-Marie Waters was running as kind of an anti-Islam candidate.
Which I suppose isn't technically racism. What is that? It's Islamophobic.
Yeah. So there are two sides to UKIP at the moment. There's the anti-Islam side and there's the side that sort of wants to look a bit less racist at a time when they're a party increasingly irrelevant because they got what the only thing that they were set up to do.
Yeah, anyway. They won.
Yeah.
They should all fuck off. That should be the conclusion.
But there was a whole thing where, like, but they don't have that many members anyway. It's in the thousands. And then quite a lot of they suspected quite a lot of far-right people joined the party at the last minute to influence the vote for Anne-Marie Waters. And then she didn't win.
Yeah, she didn't win.
Henry Bolton won, who is the more kind of Farage-loyal side of the party. And so Morrissey was suggesting that the voting had been rigged. But who cares?
Not his audience.
No.
So, Morrissey was getting a bit political this week by focusing in on a party conference, which I didn't even know was happening until Morrissey started talking about it.
Assuming it just happens in a pub somewhere now.
He wouldn't have been impressed
around
with me.
Around the table.
For not knowing what he was talking about. But thanks for that, Morrissey.
Yeah, well done. So that's it for this week's Setlist podcast. We'll be back again. Same time next week. While we're away, you can subscribe and rate and review this podcast wherever possible, anywhere you like. Some people have rated us 5 stars on Facebook already, which is very nice of them because it means we've got nice stars on Facebook.
We're still not on YouTube. So you can't rate us or listen to us or subscribe to us on YouTube.
I feel like we should stop drawing attention to that. Do people look for podcasts on YouTube?
I listen to podcasts on YouTube, but by accident. Because they come up in my YouTube feed and it's like, oh, that's interesting. I'll watch that. Anyway, That's irrelevant.
We're in a lot of other places, just not YouTube.
Can I do some plugging that's not podcast related?
No, because I haven't finished plugging.
Okay, you plug the podcast and I'm going to plug some other stuff.
You can follow us on the social media.
Oh, yeah. We've talked about that.
Setlist Pod.
Twitter, Facebook, Instagram.
That's what we are and everything.
So you can see what it is that we decide to share on Instagram when we make this podcast visual.
I'm going to get Matt to take a picture of us.
Andy Mott's going to do some more arty photography.
We're going to share a picture of us in the studio.
Perhaps
that's what we're going to do.
You live by the sea. Perhaps we could have lovely photos of the sea every week for people to share.
We could. Doesn't seem relevant.
I know, but I'm not sure there's anything relevant that we could, that we could share, apart from Spotify logos.
Sure,
endless
Morrissey.
Spotify logos. A picture of Morrissey. If anyone would like to send us a drawing of Morrissey at a UKIP party conference.
Yes, please do that.
Then we'll...
You can email that setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. Please, someone do that.
And we'll get that on the Instagram. Can I do my other plugging
we'll get
now?
That everywhere. All the social media. On the website, it will be the picture on the podcast episode. I'll put that everywhere.
My other plugs?
Yeah, go on, plug some stuff.
Okay, Music DIY is a new event from CMU DIY and the Featured Artists Coalition. The first ever edition is happening as part of Norwich Sound and Vision this coming Friday, the 13th. Friday the 13th of October. And basically, if you are an aspiring artist or songwriter or the start of your music industry career, then we, over the day, will explain to you how you build a business around your music and the business partners you will want to work with along the way. So come along to Norwich Arts Centre for Music DIY. If you go to Norwich Arts Centre's website, there's information on tickets and you can buy them there. So that's happening on Friday the 13th. So if you're in Norwich or Norfolk or anywhere in that bit of the country, then why not come along? After this podcast has finished being recorded right now, I'm off to MMF HQ, the Music Managers Forum, to tell the MMF members about the next phase of the Dissecting the Digital Dollar project. But officially, all of that's going live on the 19th of October. We've got two new guides called the Deals Guide and the Transparency Guide. I will probably tell you more about them on a future edition of Setlist. But if you go to cmuinsights.com/digitaldollar or the MMF website, you will get more information about what is coming up later this month in that domain. Here are my plugs.
Marvellous. Well, Setlist, that's presented by me, Andy Malt, and that guy, Chris Cook. It's produced by Matt Peaty. And for more on CMU, you can go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at unique facilities, Setlist is an Unlimited production.
Can I go?
No, we need to get a picture now. I've said it.
I thought wearing a picture of Morrissey by the beach.